loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, we talk through the bill that's in Congress that would avert a government shutdown and direct more money towards a crackdown on immigrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. And then today, we continue our weekly series. It's every Thursday, called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and the prisons, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. After public pressure, Amazon today canceled the New York part of their second headquarters. Since Amazon announced its decision to put one of two new headquarters in New York in January of 2019, activists have organized huge protests and a No New Home for Amazon in NYC campaign. Residents feared that rents would become even more unaffordable and were outraged at the enormous tax breaks and other perks the corporation received from state and city politicians. Vice President Pence spoke today at the Warsaw Conference on the Middle East, saying, quote, "The time has come for our European partners to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal and join with us," unquote. Since pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal last year, the Trump administration has been pressuring the European countries that are part of the deal to also back out on their commitments to sanctions relief. William Barr was confirmed in the Senate today to be the new U.S. Attorney General. The Senate voted mostly on party lines, 54 to 45. Barr will succeed Jeff Sessions, who left the role in 2018. He's expected to be sworn in today. Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza told reporters today that a newly formed group of 50 countries will be taking action, quote, "to raise awareness around the dangers that our people currently face," unquote. These countries joined together at the United Nations today to show support for Venezuela in the face of a U.S.-backed coup attempt and threats of war. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the potential agreement to avoid a government shutdown. Congress today will vote on a budget to keep the federal government open beyond midnight tomorrow, even though President Trump has not yet said whether he'll sign the measure. The deal does not include funding for the president's border wall. Susan Pye joins us from Jacksonville, Florida, where she's a noted immigration attorney and a member of a number of civil liberties and immigrant rights organizations. Susan, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you for joining. Let's talk about what this agreement, the one that appears to be on the verge of being passed by the Senate, what it does regarding immigration and border security and what it doesn't do.
Well, I think the biggest issue, you know, from the perspective of both sides is, you know, that it doesn't fund a so-called concrete wall, although it may fund a certain segment of the steel slats. And I think everybody is aware of that. I think that the Democrat proposition that the interior enforcement numbers be limited to a cap of by way of a 16,000 bed limit on detainee arrests within the interior of the United States, that's obviously off the table. That was a non-starter for the Trump administration. And by the same token, the Trump administration has to concede not only the money on the border wall or the length of the border wall, but also their desire for an increase in the mandatory minimum beds that are available to fill with immigrants in detention, whether it's in the interior or on the border. So I think those are the main highlights from the immigration side. And there really isn't much else besides that.
You know, let's talk about that issue. We discussed it, you know, with other people, John, and we're going to discuss it later in the show in some detail. But we didn't really know, I don't think a lot of people knew actually, that the U.S. government has a quota for beds.
That's right.
That must be filled with immigrant families. And it doesn't have to be people, you know, accused of a crime.
No, not at all.
It could be like just immigrants and their kids. And Susan, it would seem to us that this incentivizes the detention of people who might otherwise not be detained because the federal government's going to pay these prisons per bed to do it. Anyway, it's a large number, too. Trump wanted 52,000 beds. The Democrats wanted 45,000. I mean, why have quotas for beds for people in detention?
So this is a really interesting, it has a really interesting history that I think is counterintuitive. So what we call the bed mandate came about in 2008, 2009 as a result of the Obama administration attempting to pass comprehensive immigration reform, which obviously we've needed since the late 50s. And it was the Democrats, in concession to the Republicans, David Price in particular, who first put in the omnibus spending bill language to create what we call the bed mandate. And that requires that so much money be set aside in order at that time that 34,000 beds be made available at any one time, any minute of the day, in order to house up to that many immigrants in administrative detention. And so because whether the beds were filled or not, we still had to pay, at that time it was about $5 million a day, so about $176 per immigrant per day, whether or not those beds were filled. And so that, of course, created a de facto enforcement quota. Now, what the Democrats proposed on Monday that was struck down is exactly the opposite, and in my opinion, equally as bad. And that is an overall cap on the number of beds that could be filled for interior enforcement. So in my opinion, you know, it's as a former prosecutor, it's not a good idea to either have an immigrant quota or an immigrant cap, you know. But overall, I would say that it's not good to have enforcement quotas because, as you know, any American citizen knows, you want to go after the most dangerous criminals first because you can't bankrupt the country in order to, for example, you know, arrest everybody who, you know, urinates in public or something like that.
This is an ongoing theme, too. And we should point out, Brian, that this is not something that's unique to the Trump administration. The Obama administration had a quota of something like 45,000 beds. The Democrats were trying to reduce that to something like 30,000 or whatever it was, 25,000. But there's a possibility now that under the Trump administration, we could go up to 58,000 beds. This is a good point that we should be focused on criminals. We should be focused on people who commit violent acts, not on families who are, you know, looking for a job, frankly, a job that no American would take, and then treat them like criminals when they've not been convicted of any crime.
Susan Pye, this sounds like a racket to me.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a racket. It's a way for people. Somebody's
making a lot of money on this.
Yeah. And the immigrants are like punching bags, you know, like a useful prop.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe literally like a punching bag in the sense that they're getting hit over and over and over again. But yeah, it sounds like a racket.
Yeah, it doesn't do anything to, as both of you know, to enhance the security of the United States, most certainly. What it does is it incentivizes immigration enforcement to go after what we call low-hanging fruit. So that would be undocumented immigrants with no further crimes or family units or minors or, you know, people who are being taken advantage of by egg farms or dairy farms, for example, who are locked up in trailers overnight, for example, here on the Florida-Georgia border, and they're basically slave labor, while at the same time not punishing even close to that level the employers who are hiring them and incentivizing them, right? That's the pull factor. And so, and it also does something in terms of, you know, how immigration works with local law enforcement and how immigration works themselves. What it does is it creates a dangerous situation where local law enforcement may be called in to assist Border Patrol on very low-level criminals who are just simply in the country without documentation, which is a misdemeanor, usually punishable in criminal court for credit time served, 1 to 3 days. But they don't give the full information to the local law enforcement. And that has actually caused local law enforcement officers to unnecessarily lose their lives. And that's a real travesty. The other thing that's happened is it also creates, obviously because of the nature of immigration enforcement, an increase and very dangerous prerogative for racial profiling. So, for example, just up the street from me, there was a young kid on a bicycle who was riding on the side of the road, and yeah, he's Hispanic. He's around the area of a apartment building where there are a lot of undocumented immigrants, and Border Patrol chased him into the middle of traffic, early morning traffic. He was hit, and he died instantly. And that, these are neither one of those scenarios are something that is enhances the security of the United States or is good for the United States in any way, shape, or form.
Brian, we also see reports now about either ICE employees or employees of contractors who are running these facilities for ICE sexually abusing children under their care, stealing, selling drugs to detainees. They're hotbeds of criminal activity, and the criminal activity is on the part of the ICE employees and ICE contractors. So as things stand right now, nothing good can come of this entire situation.
And again, most of these people should not be in detention.
No, very simply, no.
Abuse in what you're describing is criminal activity, so as a consequence, never justified. But again, the victims here are people who are actually incarcerated because the U.S. government has created a system, the bed mandate being part of it, that incentivizes the arrest not of people who are suspected or for whom there's probable cause of the commission of a crime, but simply because they can be arrested because of their immigration status. It's just actually like that. Go ahead, Susan.
Yeah, so there are a couple things that you touched on. The first is there's a tremendous amount of money being generated by the two main private prison industries, CoreCivic and Geo Group. And I believe the figure is 71% of all immigrant detention centers are run by these two private prison facilities. And when you look at the amount of money that they donate, both to Democrats and Republicans, and I wrote an article about this in Huffington Post maybe 5 or 6 years ago, you know, even people like Kristen Sinema, you'll see that the Democrats have voted, not just the Republicans, but the Democrats have voted to strike down any attempts to eliminate the bed mandate. So I think this immigration issue, ironically, is a bipartisan one. And obviously, both those private prison groups do, you know, they do donate quite a bit of money to the candidates. Now, the second issue that you spoke of is a really serious one, and that's with, we saw it recently in the Southwest Key detention centers for children.
That's right.
And in one case, there was a ousted Border Patrol officer, I believe it was, who had to, he was forced out of Border Patrol because he was caught with child pornography, quite a bit of child pornography. And because of an additional issue with the prosecution of his case, the statute of, or the speedy trial ran out and they weren't unable to prosecute him. Irrespective of that, the arrest was public record. However, he became a child advocate and guardian at one of these children detention centers, and nobody knew until it was brought out in the press.
Unbelievable. And see, these articles, when they appear, and I think Susan would agree with me, you don't see them on the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post. They're in smaller outlets, smaller papers, specialty publications. You have to look for this kind of information. It's not just readily out there. I think if it was, well, I would hope that if it was, there would be outrage on Capitol Hill. Don't forget that there are congressional committees that are supposed to be overseeing this kind of thing and ensuring that it either doesn't happen or when it does happen, that someone answers for it and they fix the system so that it doesn't happen again. And we're not seeing that.
No. Go ahead, Susan.
We're not. And we've seen issues like, for example, the release of minors in custody who are not with their guardians or parents to, you know, people who are abusing them for labor, for example, on the Trillium egg farms. And that had been, you know, extensively heard by Congress during committee hearings and oversight hearings. I think it was a decade ago. And yet you see these same issues come up again, you know, over and over and over again, even in front of the same congresspeople that heard about those same issues 10 years ago. So it's really remarkable. I you know, there's a sort of a superficial news cycle with regards to immigration. And I also think that there's a problem with, obviously, Congress being primarily incentivized by their desire to, you know, stay in power and retain their positions. And that's no way to legislate. And that's certainly no way to fix, you know, the actually, they're in some ways very easily solvable immigration issues. There are ways, easy ways, to improve the immigration situation in the United States. you know, but people just aren't willing to tackle it in the right way.
Susan Pye is our guest. She joins us from Jacksonville, Florida. She's a noted immigration attorney and a member of civil liberties and immigrants' rights groups. Susan, you know, John mentioned that we don't see these kind of stories, the ones that we were just talking about, much in the mainstream media. And in a way, it's even worse than that. When you think of what Donald Trump did for the State of the Union address, he brought up as one of his guests or a number of people whose grandparents or parents had been killed by someone who happened to be an undocumented immigrant. So Trump gets them up and said, these people lost this loved, these two loved ones, this elderly couple, and it shows that the immigrants are a danger and we have to be tough and we have to have a border wall. And, you know, okay, that is a terrible tragedy. I mean, everyone's heart would go out to them. But then when we're talking about the abuse and criminal conduct directed against immigrants, including immigrant children, in detention, paid for by American taxpayers, if you shine a bright spotlight on that problem, and if the government makes that a priority, I think millions, tens of millions, maybe the majority of Americans would think, that's awful, and my heart goes out to those victims. In other words, it's kind of a manipulation of human emotions for a purely political, and I would say purely opportunist, and maybe a mostly racist cause in this case.
Yeah, there certainly are disturbing overtones, or I can't even say undertones, of racism, you know, in the rhetoric. And then we, unfortunately, words have consequences, particularly the words of our president and our commander-in-chief. And that trickles down to on-the-ground enforcement. And unfortunately, it's not just undocumented immigrants who become the victims. As I said, it's also our own law enforcement officers. It is American citizen children who are mowed down by Border Patrol over-aggressively chasing undocumented immigrants into a school zone while children are walking home. And yes, they don't give equal time to undocumented, for example, undocumented children who are particularly preyed upon by child molesters, because they know that those children and their parents are very hesitant to go to law enforcement with the stories of abuse. And as we know, child molesters, they may start molesting undocumented children or the children of undocumented immigrants who are U.S. citizens, but they're not going to stop there. So it really hurts a great majority of our society, and it opens all of our children up to dangers.
You know, John, we talked about this issue last week, because what ICE is also doing, and this is pernicious, it's also very dangerous, it is a grave threat to public safety in general and the safety of individuals. They're lurking around courthouses and arresting people who don't have documents who are coming there. Now, some of them are coming, as Susan is talking about, they're coming because they're witnesses of somebody who was abused. They're providing testimony about an abusive situation or about criminal activity. They're there because they're part of the process, but they're not the target of the process. They're arresting them. So what's the conclusion one draws? If you're an immigrant, maybe even if you have papers, but you have a family member who doesn't have papers, you don't come to court.
That's right.
You don't come to court. You don't provide assistance to that legitimate law enforcement sort of process that's targeting or trying to do something regarding a criminal abuse case, sexual abuse, trafficking, whatever. You stay away. You stay in the shadows.
And don't forget, this is the same system and the same government that just in the past few weeks has deported American citizens to Mexico, just not believing that they're Americans. And then they have to fight their way back into their own country. So would any immigrant not be frightened to show up in court to testify against somebody, knowing that the chances of their own detention and arrest and expulsion are good? I think not.
Yeah. Susan, go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're seeing a phenomenon now where U.S. citizen spouses of undocumented immigrants or even green card holders refuse to vote in any election for fear of them voting somehow affecting their spouse's status. We're also seeing And I think this is really a testament to, you know, where you're going after low-hanging fruit to fill a de facto quota, it really does take away from the national security of the United States. So in my area, for example, you know, we see families picked up, minors picked up, undocumented people picked up, law enforcement officers killed in action, going after administrative detainees.
Susan Pye is our guest. Susan, let's talk about the overall issue of immigration reform. President Obama, in the first 2 years that he was president, he had a big majority in the House, a big majority in the Senate. He was a popular president. He could have introduced, I think, and gotten past comprehensive immigration reform. He didn't try to do it then. It became increasingly more difficult as the Republicans were basically trying to, you know, say no to and stop anything that Obama introduced. Then he resorted to executive action. He introduced DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that were the Dreamers, more than a million young people. I mean, literally like babies and toddlers and young kids who had come to the United States with families who didn't have immigration papers and still, even as adults or late teens, still did not have papers. Deferred action meant that they weren't going to be prosecuted or they weren't going to be deported. They could get a work permit. They could get a license. He tried to do the same for what was called DAPA, and that would be their parents if they weren't involved in criminal activity, if they had been here a long time. It was trying to provide some relief for them. Now, the courts struck down DAPA, upheld DACA. Donald Trump, when he came into office, got rid of DACA by executive order. Again, we have 15 million undocumented people in the United States. It's obviously not possible, not that one should, but even if one wanted to, it's not possible to immediately or comprehensively deport 15 million people.
Right.
Moreover, these are 15 million mostly working people who make a big contribution to the economy, who pay taxes. So obviously, you can't get rid of everybody, even if you wanted to. So then the question is, well, who do you go after? And the argument that the Obama administration was making was, let's prioritize enforcement, which is an executive part of the executive power, focus enforcement on people who were convicted of serious crimes, not DACA dreamers, right? But that said, these are all patchwork solutions, Susan. I mean, what should comprehensive immigration reform really consist of? What needs to happen? Because obviously, the 15 million people are not going away. They're not going to be deported. They're living in the shadows. They're a targeted population. They're vulnerable to all kinds of problems, including super exploitation in wages, super exploitation in human trafficking, other places where they're vulnerable. What would comprehensive immigration reform look like from your point of view?
Well, I think that the 2013, what we call BESIOMA, the comprehensive immigration reform that was in theory agreed upon, you know, by both parties in Congress, that was a good start. That they certainly made a lot of inroads, and it sort of all came apart at the end, and not exactly sure why, but it's the current compendium of immigration law. I mean, in my opinion, it makes the IRS code look simple. It's such a nonsensical patchwork of laws, regulations, rules, executive orders, memoranda, cases, and there we really do need a comprehensive fix to that. And what really bothers me is that there are so many easy and simple and obvious fixes that can be made, but that Congress may refuse to make. For example, in the EB-5, you know, pay for your U.S. citizenship program because their donors demand it. Or there are other issues that are fundamental to immigration law, for example, what we call the 310 bar. Now, there are a lot of people in the United States who are working low-level, unskilled positions, undocumented people, who would gladly return home if the government were to remove the what we call the 310 bar. And that means if you've been in the United States for more than 6 months or a year, you are barred from returning to the United States once you step out of the country for 3 and 10 years, respectively. Now, there are a lot of older undocumented workers who have now have U.S. citizen families here, obviously, in the United States. However, they're perfectly happy to go home. They're just waiting to get deported because, in their minds, they're that's a free flight home for them, as opposed to paying for their flight home, and they just keep working until they get deported. And if we were to remove that 310 bar, many of those people would voluntarily leave the United States as long as we gave them a chance to come back and visit their U.S. citizen families. That would be a huge, monumental shift in the whole immigration landscape, especially as far as undocumented people are concerned. And so I think that if people wanted to look at, like, where we should start with comprehensive immigration reform, I think that that would be one issue. I think the other issue, it's really ironic to me because people have a real problem when I or other people refer to undocumented immigrants as illegal, and then the normal response is no person is illegal. However, in reality, because I've practiced both in criminal court and in administrative court, immigration court, if immigrants were considered criminals and they prosecuted them as criminals, they certainly are punished as criminals now, they would have a whole compendium of rights that they don't otherwise have right now that cause a lot of problems. And that includes the right to a public defender. So in actuality, it would be more beneficial if they were treated as criminals. And even now, if somebody is prosecuted for illegal reentry in the criminal arena, in criminal district court, they're going to serve maybe 1, 3, 5 days in custody, even a multiple reentrant. The maximum amount of time that I've seen Jeff Sessions sentence that person to is 60 days. But most of the time, it's credit time served. However, in administrative court, which is a non-criminal arena, those same people, once they are criminally convicted, they move on to the administrative side to get deported. Now, those people might spend 6 months, 1 year, 3 years, 5 years in custody at a cost of about $220 a day to the U.S. taxpayer. So it just doesn't make any sense the way that the system is now.
That's Susan Pye. She's an attorney. Susan, you know, there are 12 million people passed through Ellis Island between, you know, 1892 and in the early parts of the 1920s. Most of them did not have any papers. They didn't have passports. They didn't have visas. They were checked to make sure they didn't have smallpox and to find out whether or not they had a family member who already resided and lived in the United States. That's how a whole lot of people got to the United States. Under this current system, they'd all be criminals, or as you're putting it, maybe not criminals in one sense, but certainly treated perhaps worse than criminals. 20 seconds left.
Yeah, Trump's grandfather was deported from his country to the United States. Trump's mother was an overstay.
Boy, if that isn't rich, huh?
Yeah, and the same with John Kelly. You know, all these people. I mean, it's very rich, and it says so much. Anyway, we are completely out of time. We were joined by Susan Pye. She joined us from Jacksonville, Florida. Susan is a noted immigration attorney and a member of a number of civil liberties and immigrant rights organizations. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined here in the studio by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Thank you.
As usual, so much to talk about. But Kevin, you've been writing about Corizon. This is the prison healthcare giant. You know, every time we mention Corizon, every time any of us writes about Corizon, it's to talk about some kind of egregious failure on the company's part that's resulted in the death or dismemberment of somebody, of some prisoner somewhere. Why don't you start with that?
Well, I suppose the most amazing thing is that the reason why we're going to talk about Corizon today is that they have lost their contract in Arizona. And for people who listen to us regularly, you maybe would have thought there is nothing that could make a state decide to cut off a contract with some private contractor, because we talk about so many egregious offenses, so many things like failing to treat somebody who has cancer, which is like the lead for this appeal piece that was written by Elizabeth Wild Greenberg, talking about the failure to treat skin cancer for one of these prisoners. And so you would have thought that maybe there was nothing that was going to make the Arizona state decide to cut off this contract. But apparently something happened. They decided they'd had enough. They've cut this contractor, this notorious contractor, loose. And so now with that pattern of neglect behind the state of Arizona, they now have the issue of who do they bring in to operate the prison healthcare system. And we just can take a quick moment. You know, we can go back to Corizon, but I just think the whole system, it really doesn't quite matter who you bring in as the private contractor. And there's also the issue of if you bring in somebody who's maybe publicly contracted, what's going to happen? It's really difficult to tell because there's so many ways in which the system is set up that it incentivizes not providing care to prisoners.
Paul, let me read to you the first paragraph of an article about this this contract being dropped. It says here, by the time Walter Jordan began radiation therapy on July 21st, 2017, his skin cancer had already eaten through his skull and spread to his brain, according to a doctor who later reviewed the medical files. Jordan, who was incarcerated in a state prison in Florence, Arizona, had squamous cell cancer, a type of skin cancer that has more than a 90% cure rate. About a week before his death, Jordan wrote to the U.S. District Court, quote, Arizona Department of Corrections and Corizon delayed treating my cancer. Now, because of their delay, I may be lucky to be alive for 30 days. Is this the exception or is this the rule for Corizon?
No, unfortunately, this is the norm for not just Corizon, but all of the privatized medical companies. But I think it's also worth noting that it's not like the government-run prison medical care is any panacea either. And it's not like all too often in prison legal news we report, you know, doctors that have extensive disciplinary histories, they literally can't get jobs anywhere else. They have lengthy histories of sexually assaulting their patients, killing their patients. They're uninsurable. And then they come to work for prisons and jails. And these companies, basically, their entire business model is premised upon the notion of get as much money from the taxpayers as possible and provide as little service as possible. We've often called it the HMOs from hell. And, you know, and we see this revolving door with companies. Like the fact that Corizon is losing the contract or getting booted from Arizona doesn't really mean a lot because they're going to get replaced with another company. I'm not aware of a single state or jail that once they have privatized their medical system has gone back to bring it under government control. They just do this revolving door of they have one contractor, there's a series of high-profile deaths or incidents, as they call them, and they'll ditch that contract. They bring another contractor in, and they'll hold the contract until the same thing happens. And it's just this ongoing pattern.
This prisoner who died from a curable cancer, Walter Jordan, said in his letter to the U.S. District Court judge that for his cancer, that, as I said in the opening paragraph here, literally ate through his skull and went into his brain. He was given Tylenol. And that's normal. We've talked about that on this show. That's pretty much what anybody gets. And I want to make one comment, too, on your comment about doctors, even in the federal system, which is supposed to be so much better than state systems around the country. It's not. But and this is just anecdotal, but the doctor at FCI Loretto, where I was incarcerated, was a disgraced pediatrician who had been fired from the Cleveland Clinic just because he was a terrible doctor. Remember, 50% of all doctors graduate in the bottom half of their class, right? So the bad doctors have to go somewhere. Well, a lot of them go to the prison systems.
Well, and I think this goes back to when I was in prison in Washington State. The what they do in Washington, and as they do in a lot of states, is, for example, doctors rack up disciplinary charges through the Medical Quality Assurance Commission or wherever the board is that regulates doctors. And in this case, the doctor, he had a history of sexually assaulting his female patients. He was a gynecologist. He sexually assaulted his female patients. They suspended his license, but then they suspended his suspension as long as he only treated adult male patients. Well, the only place he can have an adult male patient clientele is a men's prison. And so for a couple of years there, I could say I was going to go see my gynecologist. But this is a pattern that plays itself out over and over again. And you know, you don't see much in the way of accountability, and there's very little political will. I mean, on the one hand, I think that it's correct and it's accurate to note these private prison companies, their horrible track records, their profit incentivizations to delay and deny medical care and to literally kill people in order to make money. But at the end of the day, it's the government that gives them these contracts. Mm-hmm. It's the government that incentivizes them. It's the government that's giving them our taxpayer money to provide the substandard medical care. And everyone knows this is what's going to happen. This isn't like an unforeseen circumstance. And it's very obvious because their whole business model is premised upon get the money from the government, don't provide medical care because medical care costs money.
That's right. Just give Tylenol. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, and I just wanted to say, like, Paul's suggesting you can cut ties with Corizon, but then any one of these other top market players that are out there have records that are probably very close. You know, they may not be as notorious as Corizon, but they have records of abuse. They've had lawsuits. So you can go to Correct Care Solutions, you go to Centurion, you go to Wexford. Any of those other ones, though, have problems in other states that you can easily find. And then I think the dynamic that Paul is talking about is important. This whole thing of, well, let's take, for example, if you take a contractor like Centurion in Florida, which I know Paul will be able to talk about a lot because he's from there, you know, they're basically jacking up the costs of their contract and extracting millions from the state. And then meanwhile, the state is under pressure to make cuts because they are run by Republicans who believe in balancing a budget. So then they cut social services, they cut reentry centers, they cut mental health care, they cut all the things that help people. And then you're loading the prisons up with more inmates, and you're basically benefiting the prison system is getting more people to work with, and it further justifies having this lucrative contract.
Yeah, absolutely right. Kevin, I want to move on to another issue. It's a piece that was written by your colleague, Brian Sonnenstein, at shadowproof.com. He's talking about the maximum security prison in California, Corcoran. Corcoran's a notorious prison. Very famous serial killers have been held there. It's got a reputation as being a violent place, too. But what you have written about, and Brian Sonnenstein has written about, is that the violence is not necessarily on the part of the prisoners.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things that is being called attention to, and this again, just to be very clear here, is coming amidst this lockdown that has been ongoing. The fact that they would like it to end. They've been trying to make negotiations. They've engaged in prisoner-led resistance, tried to have a hunger strike, get negotiations. Comes no shock to us all that the warden hasn't been engaging in good faith negotiations. But the main issue here for these prisoners is something that people probably have heard about if they follow prison issues, which is this thing that the prisoners call gladiator fights, which is basically where at least two people would be let out of their cells while everyone's on lockdown. And then those people are basically able to go at each other and engage in a fight. And then the nurses and some of the guards are standing by. They're there to break it up and then take people off and do some bandaging up. You know, obviously they're not getting very good healthcare treatment as we've talked about in prisons. But this issue of people, the way in which they're able to exercise their authority and control over prisoners and perpetuate this violence in these facilities, it's something that these prisoners are calling attention to. And it apparently has not been taken care of as much as it's been a huge issue. You know, we now have in California, they have Governor Gavin Newsom. As much as it's been an issue for California lawmakers and people who run the government there, it still hasn't been eradicated. It still exists. It's still a practice that's ongoing in this facility.
Paul, you've watched these issues for decades. How common is this nonsense about gladiator fights and 24-hour-a-day lockdowns where prisoners have to go on hunger strikes just to get the necessities for daily life?
Well, what I was going to say is about, you know, when Kevin is mentioning Corcoran is, unfortunately, the saga goes back decades. And the downside about reporting on this stuff for decades is there's very little new under the sun. Back in the late 80s and the early 90s, when Corcoran first opened up, it led the nation in prison guards setting up these gladiator fights and then shooting and killing the participants.
My God. Where was that?
In Corcoran.
Oh, my God.
We did a bunch of stories on it, and ultimately, two prison guards blew the whistle. They went to the FBI about the guards setting up prisoners and these staged fights and then shooting and killing them. And this in the context that Corcoran had more shootings of prisoners by guards in, I think it was like a 3-year period, than the entire United States did combined. You know, just to put this into context.
Incredible.
And ultimately, I think, as something that we're all too used to, so ultimately, the only people who lost their jobs and were punished were the two whistleblowers who went to the FBI to report the setup and staged shootings and killings. And there was a series of lawsuits, and supposedly they revamped their use of force protocols, because this was literally a case where prisoners were getting into fist fights and guards were shooting to kill with 9mm carbines from the guard towers. And of course, the guards were setting it up, so they knew that a fight was likely to happen or imminently going to happen, and they were just waiting to gun down the participants. And they did this for years. And got away with it. There was quite the body count. Yes, there were some lawsuits, but ultimately, none of the guards were convicted of any criminal offenses. The only ones who ultimately lost their jobs because of it were the two whistleblowers.
In keeping with the theme of hunger strikes, and this is how desperate things are in the prison system, where the only thing that actually will bring the other side to the table, the administration to the table, is a hunger strike, a real hunger strike. Kevin, let's talk about a hunger strike at an ICE facility, an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in California.
Yeah, so just quickly, I want to point out the source here. Brian and I at Shadowproof, we just found out about it. Maybe you don't know about it, and maybe people listening would like to know that there's this project now called Perilous Chronicle that's apparently putting together a living history of prisoner resistance. So people can find it at perilouschronicle.com, and that's where we're finding the description of this and the news that there's a strike that started at this ICE-operated detention facility in California. It's called Yuba County Jail. And so we've got 50 immigrant detainees, basically, who have launched a strike. And I thought it would be good to highlight it on our show. And, you know, basically, they're demanding the same sort of basic treatment that all prisoners in other facilities demand, but perhaps more interesting would be to know that, you know, they're upset about bugs and mold in the showers, that they usually detainees suffer from lack of translation services. So they probably are having a lot like difficulty understanding what's expected of them, which, you know, can get them into a lot of trouble. They want timely medical care. And then, of course, they're dealing with temperature issues of it being too cold and toilets being plugged, sinks being plugged, malfunctioning, as well as lack of hot water in the showers. Of course, these are, you know, as Paul will point out, these are common to every facility, but you've got basically immigrants who have to go on strike in order to get any sort of basic dignity while they're incarcerated. And I imagine that these are people waiting for deportation or wondering if they're going to be deported.
Yeah, this is a kind of a common thing. It's become a common theme. I wrote recently in Reader Supported News about how ICE employees and ICE contractors have been arrested just over the last couple of months for raping children in some of these facilities. So yeah, it's everything that we face in prisons across the country. All these terrible, monstrous events that we see in prisons are beginning to happen in ICE facilities, and oftentimes happening to children.
I think it's been going on in ICE facilities for a long time. I think that part of the problem, though, is that to an extent that immigration prisoners have been more of an invisible population, simply because, you know, there's language barriers, they're somewhat transient. But there's definitely been, I think, a lot of abuse as far as, you know, the sexual assaults, the use of force, you know, the horrific conditions. I mean, some of the stuff that gets very, very little attention are these temporary holding pens that the Border Patrol uses around the border. I mean, when I've talked to immigration detainees, they call them los congeladores, or the freezers, where they've got these holding pens on the border. They're heavily refrigerated, literally. Detainees and border crossers are held in these for hours or days on end before they're transferred to other facilities, and they're literally being frozen. And I think this is all part of the so-called deterrence policy that started long before Donald Trump took office, but it goes back several administrations, at least back to the Clinton administration, designed to subject people to these horrible conditions. And a theory as well, if we treat them badly enough, they'll self-deport, they'll give up any appeals, any asylum claims they may have, and they'll be dissuaded from coming to the United States.
You know, I want to just jump in and ask Kevin to comment on, you know, this is the day after we heard that there's an agreement between the Democrats and the Republicans over border security. And part of this agreement is something that I think very few people in the United States know about, which is the quota for the number of beds that the government will fund for ICE detention facilities. Trump had wanted 52,000 beds, and the Democrats, being the militant fighters for justice that they are, were insisting that it only be 45,000 beds. Doesn't this, Kevin Gustala, incentivize arresting and detaining immigrants, their kids, not because they're criminals, just because there's a quota here and there's a lot of money to be made? I think people don't know that this mechanism actually is leading to the unnecessary incarceration of immigrant families.
Yeah, so the debate in our political class is, can we warehouse more refugees who are fleeing violence in Central America? And the Democrats reply, no, we don't think you should warehouse that many. We'll let you warehouse 7,000 to 10,000 less refugees. And that's the debate that is being had. And yeah, what we're really talking about here, when Donald Trump talks about a wall, when you hear Republicans go on, or when you see Democrats claim to have some compassion through so-called comprehensive immigration reform, what we're really talking about is reinforcing a system that is not giving asylum seekers the ability to make their cases. You know, you have stories of children who are, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years old. We got toddlers who are asked to make their own case before a judge that they should be given asylum so that they can come into the country and not be deported. Or you've got families that are separated. And then, of course, you have mass deportations, or you have them warehoused here in the United States so that somebody, some CEO of one of these companies, can make millions, if not billions of dollars off of having them imprisoned and to do labor, to do slave labor, to do the kind of labor that not only is happening at immigrant detention facilities, but also we've talked about happening at our federal or state facilities. And so, yeah, that's what this is really all about. It's not, you know, it's not about trying to challenge Donald Trump. It's about, hey, we think there is an amount of refugees that we could have as a quota for detention beds.
And I think it's also worth noting is the amount of money that these companies make, specifically CoreCivic, formerly known as Corrections Corporation of America, and Geo Corporation. They pretty much have the lock on the immigration detention market. And the federal government pays these companies $160,000, $170,000 a day for each immigrant detainee that's being held in these facilities. And to put this into perspective, states like Mississippi are paying these companies $27, $29 a day to house prisoners that are state prisoners under criminal convictions. So there's a lot more money to be made caging immigration detainees than there are plain old American criminals. And these companies have largely been set up to profit from this. And that's literally what's floating the profits of, you know, of the American private prison industry. But the other thing is, you know, unless we think that this is all just recent development, for those who've been covering this stuff for a while, back in 2000, 2001, the private prison industry of GEO and Corrections Corporation of America at the time, they were imploding under their own mismanagement and corruption and problems that they had. Their stocks were trading at 19, 20 cents a share. They're in the process of being delisted. And it was Bill Clinton and Congress that basically bailed out these private prison companies with these sweetheart immigration contracts that started the bed quota system, where these companies were being guaranteed a minimum at these highly inflated prices of caging immigration detainees. And it's also worth noting these companies get paid this amount regardless of how many people are actually being locked up. It's they've got these minimum occupancy quotas, which, you know, the analogy has been likened to if you're running a hotel and you're going to get paid regardless of how many guests you actually have in the hotel. That's a pretty sweet gig if you're the hotel owner. And these private prison companies have taken that. It's not even an analogy. The reality is they're getting paid regardless of how many people they're actually caging at very, very high rates. And basically, this is just a sweetheart subsidy from the government that goes back to the Clinton administration and has basically been going on for almost 20 years now, that basically keeps the private prison industry afloat in this country and profitable and funnels taxpayer money directly into the coffers of these companies' shareholders and investors.
John, I think these are important points that we're talking about here, and people don't actually think about immigration or crime from the point of view of it being a profit-making business.
Right.
When you get down to it, it is. There's all sorts of moral assertions or what's best for society. Because I'm a socialist, as you know, John, I like to quote some of my favorite socialists. I want to quote this and then get you and others to talk about it. People always have been the foolish victims of deception and self-deception in politics, and they always will be until they've learned to seek out the interests of some class or other behind all moral, religious, political, and social phrases, declarations, and promises. The class basis of these systems, it's obvious now in the most transparent way when we're talking about profit for prisons, including you can make more money detaining innocent immigrants and their kids than you can, say, people who are convicted of felonies in the state of Mississippi, which is what Paul's talking about. Again, the class basis of this system.
It really is a class-based system. You really get that when you get to prison and you see that it's essentially 1950s America. You're separated by race, and then even within race, you're separated by class. And that's just the way it is. There's nothing you can do about that. It's a reality of today's prison system. That actually leads to another issue that I wanted to raise. There was a piece in Vox yesterday that I think is very important. And it talks about this notion that all sentences should be capped at 20 years. That may sound radical. It's actually not radical. Most of our Western European allies cap their sentences at 20 years or 25 years, and it works. Their crime rates are lower than ours, and their recidivism rates are lower than ours. I don't think that tomorrow people are going to have a collective epiphany that the right thing to do is to cap sentences at 20 years, but I think this is a conversation that we really should be having. Paul?
I was going to say is I think that, you know, most Americans, I think, that follow criminal justice issues realize how out of whack the United States is on the death penalty. They realize that, okay, most industrialized countries, I mean, with the exception of Japan, I don't think any other industrialized country kills its own citizens. I mean, most civilized countries have long since abolished the death penalty, as I think it's a majority of the world's countries have officially abolished it. It's not just the death penalty. It also goes to the rest of the sentencing. And the rest of the world has sentences that they have maximum sentences, regardless of what you're convicted of. The most amount of time you're going to be able to do is X amount, for example. And it's not just Western democracies. I mean, China has a 20-year maximum sentence. Brazil has a 30-year sentence. Mexico has 40. And, you know, and it's interesting, though, but the concept where this starts from, the Mexican Constitution embodies the notion that everyone can be rehabilitated. Everyone is entitled to be rehabilitated if they've been convicted of a crime. And, you know, and even if they fail at this, at least they're trying. At least there's a conceptual basis for it. And the notion here in the United States, one of the biggest things that we've seen is even as the use of the death penalty is falling, we've seen the rise of death by incarceration, not just the life without parole sentences that ensure people are going to die caged in prisons, often from medical neglect, but rather the whole notion that we've got these, when I was in prison, they were called the Buck Rogers sentences. And you see this where judges and prosecutors engage in this actuarial calculation of how old is the defendant, how much time, how long of a sentence should we get them to ensure that they die in prison? And I think this is just an ongoing thing that we've seen that if anything has intensified in the last 20 or 30 years, and it's been a real race to the bottom. And I think we're long overdue for bringing some type of reality check into this, namely the notion that, hey, people only have one life to live, and how much is a good sentence or a long sentence.
Kevin, we've got a minute left. Why don't you take us out?
How about I make a quick book recommendation?
Awesome.
So along this topic, I finished, it's called The Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences. This is a project that was put out by the Sentencing Project. And it speaks to what we're saying here about how there's no practical or moral reason for having any sentence longer than 20 years. And, you know, essentially, after that time, most prisoners, if they have criminal tendencies, you know, they abandon them. They've aged out of going back to that sort of criminal lifestyle that they may have had before they were sent to prison. And I think it's important. And also, one of the main points it makes is that the death penalty, you know, we can abolish it, but then you still have life sentences, and also having the death penalty in America, not abolishing it like most of the world, means that we have more extreme sentences for lower crimes. And so there's so much that we have to address here. And getting at capping sentences is a first sort of thing to really changing and altering this system.
Yeah, I think he's exactly right. Okay, we will leave it at that. We were joined here in the studio by Paul Wright. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. And Kevin Gastala joined us from Chicago. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and Clear.